Here's a question out of left field for Dr. Kaku, just changing directions slightly, concerning the time travel paradox of returning to the past and killing one's grandfather. Mm-hmm. People like yourself, Doctor, currently, I guess, believe the solution would be the creation of multiple universes. I would respectfully suggest that this violates the law of parsimony. It is not the simplest solution to the problem. Instead, creation of an entire universe, creation of an entire new universe is a inefficient solution. I'm reading an email here. Has no one ever suggested a different perspective? What if each person instead carries with him or her their own, in essence, model universe? Personal relationships would be interactions and changes in point of contact of each person's model universe. In this solution, there'd be one universe for each sentient being, which would interact and change the universes of other sentient beings, other realities, such as mountains, oceans, planets, and stars, would be jointly shared by each person's model universe. In this solution, the crime, murder of the grandfather, would instantly cause DNA changes in the murdering grandson and his father, possibly several other offspring of the grandfather. This problem could get pretty messy, but it would respectfully suggest it's a far better solution, this emailer thinks, than creating a whole new universe out of nothing.
Okay, there are two major solutions to what happens when you kill your parents before you're born.
Right.
The other approach is advocated by physicist Igor Novikov. The Russian school believes that there's something called causality protection. Something prevents you from pulling the trigger as you point the gun to your parents before you're born. Now,
it just couldn't happen, is what
he's saying.
That's right.
He's saying that there's some kind of law of physics which he cannot elucidate in detail. Hmm. Now, he also says that you cannot walk on the ceiling. You may want to walk on the ceiling. Free will says, I want to walk on the ceiling. But there's a law, a physical law that prevents you from walking on the ceiling called the law of gravity. So he would like to postulate that, yes, there must be a physical law of some sort preventing you from pulling the trigger of the gun pointed at your parents before you're born.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't know quite what this thing is. He just calls it causality protection hypothesis. However, I tend to think that perhaps that interpretation is wrong, because even inanimate matter, you know, forget sentient beings, inanimate matter can also create paradoxes. Let's say I get a machine gun, and I simply sent it back into the past and give it to Alexander the Great.
That's a very good
enemy.
Point. Yes.
And, you know, just inanimate matter going back into the past, given to Darius the Great, the Persian.
That's a very good point.
Would allow him to destroy Alexander the Great's troops, in which case we'd all be speaking a Persian right now rather than a European language.
Hmm.
So even inanimate matter, forget sentient beings, even inanimate matter can create time travel paradoxes. So that's why I believe that even though some people think the many worlds interpretation has too much excess baggage, it is one of the dominant interpretations of the quantum theory.
All right.
So many Nobel laureates, Steve Weinberg, Murray Gell-Mann, these are giants in physics, Nobel laureates, who say that, yeah, some version of many worlds theory is probably what is really happening. And we just live in one branch of this much larger tree. And it does mean that there's another universe where Elvis is still alive. There's another universe where, you know, aliens are walking the street.
When do you think, Professor, that we might, what is the right word I guess I'm searching for, verify the existence of one of these alternate universes, actually manage to, in some manner, perhaps even interact with it, communicate, watch it, monitor it, do something with it, anything at all? I mean, is that in our future?
Well, that's the subject of my next book after Einstein Cosmos comes out. That book is called Parallel Worlds. It's going through final editing right now, and it'll come out perhaps a full year from now.
Incredible.
And in Parallel Worlds, I ask that very question. If there is a multiverse, and all the data points to a multiverse now, the WMAP satellite came out in February with the precise age of the universe. The universe is 13.7 billion years old, plus or minus 1%. And the leading theory that fits that data is something called inflation. And inflation, in turn, is based upon a multiverse of universes, bubbles forming constantly, so that our universe is coexist with other bubbles. And even as we speak, big bangs have been taking place. And then the question is, what about leaving our bubble? The WMAP satellite in February released data that indicates that we're all going to freeze to death trillions of years from now.
Yes.
And it is kind of depressing, but sooner or later, everything runs down.
Not nearly so depressing as the first, couple and a half hours of the show we've just done. Actually, that says to me, don't worry about freezing to death because you're not going to make it. I mean, I'm a brutal odds guy, and as I listen to you, the chance of us getting through this proliferation without it all coming down around our heads, it's pretty slim.
Yeah, but I think the way to deal with all these depressing facts is action. You know, I mean, Einstein, many of the great giants of the age, Niels Bohr, others, said we must translate our knowledge into action. So they circulated petitions.
They're trying to do that on the other side, too, you know, translate
right.
their ideas into...
That's right. So, again, history belongs to those people who can seize the initiative. And I think it's a good thing that all the citizens of this country get activated to participate in the electoral process, to get energized, and make your statement felt at the voting booth.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we should have an agenda that does put forth a future where we have a future.
By the way, speaking of agendas and something a little more cheerful, we were going to have a program tonight where we were going to talk about the future of outer space, for example. The president is about to make a big speech. All rumor is that he's going to announce the U.S. going back into space, going to the moon or maybe even a base on the moon for going to Mars and all kinds of stuff that he might say.
Mm-hmm.
Anniversary of the Wright brothers. And so I did want to get a word or two from you on how you feel about all this.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I think we should have a permanent moon base. However, I think it should be robotic. We left the moon, we went there, scored a touchdown, came back with our football, and just left the moon there. I think we should have a permanent presence on the moon.
Why robotic?
Because it'd be cheap, wouldn't be dangerous. We would be able to do 10 times more things because they're 10 times cheaper. They don't have to come back. They don't require life support. And we should have these things on the moon. If you saw the movie 2001, of course, the whole movie is prefaced on the idea that there are uncharted areas of the moon, talking about previous visitations from aliens.
Absolutely.
And like I said, I believe that if aliens have ever gone past our solar system, the most likely place for them to have a base or had a base is the moon.
Would you think there's a fair chance we actually might uncover some sort of robotic obelisk if we dig around enough on the moon?
I can't rule it out. It is the most mathematically efficient way to explore the solar system. Forget Captain Kirk. The self-replicating von Neumann probes on the moon would be the ideal place to colonize and investigate the galaxy. Because, enterprises and Captain Kirks are very expensive and there are very few of them, but self-replicating robotic probes self-replicate. They live off the land. You don't have to do anything. They simply replicate and explore other moons. And our moon is ideal because it circles a planet that has liquid water. Liquid water is a universal solid. The alien that came through our solar system millions, billions of years ago would have picked out our Earth as the possible mother of life in the future. And they would have left a probe on the moon waiting for us.
Let me ask you a question about that probe. Let's say we find one, Professor. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I take you back years to a moment where we actually transmitted from Arecibo, using the wonderful giant dish at Arecibo, we transmitted a very short transmission to go scorching out in way past everything to whatever life might be out there. We did fire one transmission in one direction, and after that, Professor, they said, you're not doing it anymore. And the reason you're not going to do it anymore, and they were serious about this, is we don't know what the consequences would be of our message getting received. And maybe, somebody will receive it, and maybe we won't be so happy about the fact that they did. In other words, they might not be friendly.
They look at us and say, lunch.
Right? Or whatever, yes. And so now we've got an obelisk on the moon. If we, would you recommend going ahead, for example, and uncovering that obelisk, giving it an opportunity, as it did in 2001, to make a transmission that suddenly alarms our presence, or would you advise against it? What a moment of choice that one would be.
Well, first of all, the object's probably been there for millions of years.
Yes.
And, in other words, it's been sending reports all along.
Yes.
About the status of carbon-based life forms on a planet that has liquid water.
So you're figuring they're watching already?
They're probably watching already. Right. And they're probably a great distance away, so they're not going to be able to come visit us anytime soon. However, it does mean that we have to realize that we're probably not alone in the universe, that the moon is the most likely place for a visitation.
Sure.
And that if we go back to the moon, I think that should be in the back of the mind of anyone who wants to set up a permanent moon base there.
Right. Let's say it is. And let's say you discover the obelisk, Professor.
Yeah, there are huge parts of the moon that are totally unexplored.
Would you recommend dinging it up and activating it? In other words, what kind of calculation, as a physicist, scientist, would you make about the nature of the people we would eventually meet as a result of what we were about to do?
Well, in the movie, an astronaut touches the obelisk and it sends a message to the home planet. That, you know, like a screaming message, right?
That's right.
I would suspect that we should first just analyze it to see what kinds of technologies are involved. For example, nanotechnology is probably not very big, in which case they've probably been able to harness nanotechnology millions of years ago. And that's why these things could be quite small and is probably capable of self-replication. And so it's probably quite sophisticated. And the moon is very stable, been stable for, 3-4 billion years.
Mm-hmm.
So an obelisk like this would be stable for an extended period of time. And it's probably already been sending messages. So, but, you know, we don't want to activate it unnecessarily because we don't know their intentions.
There you are. I was wondering if you would recommend extreme caution in that regard.
I'll recommend extreme caution, yes.
And I wonder, what kind of debates would there be about the merit of activation?
No, we send radio and television to outer space. You know, we send Beavis and Butthead into outer space. And any intelligent being that picks up Beavis and Butthead would wonder whether there's any intelligent life worth contacting.
You and I are on the way out there right now.
Right. And so I think, however, that any intelligent being realizing that a planet with liquid water would be an ideal arena to create the autocatalytic molecules called DNA would be quite curious and have, you know, regular reports. So this obelisk has been sending reports.
Yes.
So I don't think we have to fear it. They would have been here causing havoc years before it hit.
So then scientifically you would conclude that if they wanted to dispose of us in some unsavory manner, that would have already occurred.
That's right. And however, that's why I think that a permanent moon base would actually be a good idea. Not only would we know more about the origin of the moon, the solar system, solar storms, and we had a huge solar storm just last month, you know.
Oh, it was it was incredible.
It wiped out 2 satellites.
Incredible. Yes. Oh, by the way, yes, we've only got a few moments, but a comment on the recent spate of outrageous solar activity. I mean, you know, in a part of the cycle where there's no way this should be happening, I'm not saying it can't happen, but almost no way we should be getting super flares.
Yeah, this is the biggest in 150 years.
Yeah.
You have to go back to 1850-something or other. That storm was so big, by the way, that telegraph keys, telegraph lines activated all by themselves without any electricity. It actually induced electricity to send telegraph signals.
Right.
That's how powerful it was back then.
Right.
So the storm luckily missed us. The sunspot was pointing the wrong direction. As the sun spins, this one sunspot was ejecting all this the solar flares and radiation into the atmosphere, into outer space. Luckily, it was pointed the wrong way. And so we missed the bullet. If that bullet had hit,
yes,
it could have destroyed a good fraction of the satellites. Your TV screen would have been wiped out. Your radio transmission, the internet, probably all would have gone.
God, the end of civilization as we know.
And power lines would have been had power surges in power lines. It would have been very messy had that solar flare hit us. And it just goes to show you that we don't know that much about the sun. Sunspot cycles are 11 years, of course, but we're in the middle of the sunspot cycle. we were not due for another.
I'm so fascinated, Professor, that I sit with the 1-minute x-ray chart. During that time, I just sat with the 1-minute x-ray chart up on my screen, and there were a couple of times I went right through the roof. I mean, as the vertical line would start and go shooting up past the high X category, mm-hmm. I started going, oh my God, this is really, really, really serious. And I was talking to a bunch of people, friends on ham radio about it, and it was quite a time, and it may not be over. Any guesses, Professor, what's going on with our sun?
Well, this caught a lot of people by surprise. Mm. We categorize these by the letter X, and so we give them numbers, and this was almost off scale. And if you take a look at the last 150 years...
It actually was off scale.
Yeah, there have only been like three other incidents that even came close, but the biggest one was 150 years ago. So this is definitely one of the big ones. And, you know, it grazed us. And like I said, it knocked out two satellites, knocked out communications in certain areas.
But do you think we could be entering a period of time with some strange, unnatural output of the sun? In other words, I guess I'm asking, could it be perhaps not over yet?
Well, it's not over yet. There was another mini storm just 2 weeks ago, another aftershock.
Yes.
And these sunspots do rotate around the sun. You know, the sun flips its north pole and south pole every 11 years.
Yes,
and
sir.
The flipping of the poles sends a shockwave, and that shockwave creates the aurora borealis and the southern lights and the northern lights every 11 years. But this was kind of unexpected, because this should be a quiet time for the sun, and it just goes to show you that the sun has a lot of tricks that we didn't quite anticipate.
Uh-huh.
And not to mention that the Earth's magnetic field is also beginning to decay.
Well, you know, I meant to mention that too. I just read a story about
10% in the last century.
Yeah, much more. And then they're saying it could accelerate too, and really accelerate.
Yeah, if the Earth's magnetic field were to go kaput, and like I said, it's dropped 10% already just in the last century, it would be quite dangerous. There'd be lots of radiation coming down from the sun.
We're almost talking the movie Core here.
However, sure. We're not talking about destabilizing the center of the Earth.
But, I know, but magnetic field down, sun up, not good.
And also it could also mean that the poles may shift again. You know, the magnetic poles have shifted in the past. If you go to Hawaii and simply dig in the lava flows, you can actually see the magnetic pointing that was frozen in time many millions of years ago.
That also flipping. Possibly not good.
Yeah, so the poles could migrate, or the poles could gradually damp. This is all quite speculative. No one really knows for sure. But we do know that the Earth's magnetic field is dropping to a degree. And, within centuries to millennia, maybe it'll go to zero.
And on that note, Professor, we're out of time. I could go on forever. God, it's great to talk to you, and I'll look forward to doing it the next time. But we're out of time.
Mm-hmm.
We're out of time. Professor, thank you.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Good night.
Okay.
Here's Crystal. She's got all just exactly the right words to take us out of here. See you next time or next weekend, whichever comes sooner. I'm Art Bell. Good night.
Midnight in the desert, shooting stars across the sky. This magical journey will take us on a ride. Filled with the longing, searching for the truth. Will we make it to tomorrow? Will the sun shine on you? Midnight in the desert.